You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear about the discovery of some long-forgotten scientific discoveries by George Washington Carver here in Wisconsin.
First, in his budget proposal for the next 2 years, Governor Scott Walker proposed divvying up $42.5 million in new state funding for UW campuses based on performance measures. A new analysis of that proposal from higher education expert Nick Hillman shows which campuses would win and which would lose under that proposal.
Karen Herzog joins us now to talk about this analysis and how these performance measures might work. She's a higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Karen, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you, Rob.
Well, before we get into how this whole system would work, from what we know of it so far and this analysis, would there be winner and loser campuses in going after this performance-based funding?
When you look at the measures and you average everything out, yes, you could argue that there are winners and losers, and that there are a lot of ways that this, if the idea of performance-based funding is to be used, there are a lot of ways that perhaps it could be organized differently. Madison comes out in all the measures. You're talking graduation rates, time to degree, a number of other areas. There are two measures of the 18 that the governor has suggested that another campus would rank number one. And that's Platteville, which actually would have the highest percentage of students doing internships and the highest share of degrees in healthcare and STEM. But remember, that's a smaller campus. UW Parkside and UW-Milwaukee are at the bottom of the list in terms of how much of this $42.5 million they would get over the next biennium.
So in a way, this is a competition between the campuses based on how they rank in these, as you said, 18 different categories, right? They would be sort of looking head-to-head in those results.
Yes, and that's one of the things that Nick Hillman, who is an expert on higher education policy at UW-Madison, that's one of the things that he pointed out is other states, there are 34 states so far that either have performance-based funding, at least to some degree, or are starting to put it into place. So it's not unusual to have it, but he isn't aware of any states that use a ranking system that pits campuses against each other to compete for funding, because one of the main reasons that he suggests you don't do that is you really aren't necessarily accomplishing your goals of improving the quality of the education, the number of graduates that you get who are employable, efficiency of campuses. And basically what you're just doing is creating sort of a cannibalism of the money that's available.
And in a way, you're not really comparing apples with apples on different campuses. Can you talk about how different campuses in the UW system have different missions and how that might impact some of these measures?
Well, that's a really important point. Now, of course, Wisconsin Technical College is about 30% of the funding they receive is tied to performance measures. Now, in the case of UW's system, the campuses, the four-year campuses, all have slightly different missions, and the student populations are very different. For example, Madison, obviously, as the research institution, the flagship, is highly selective. And you compare it to UW Parkside and UW Milwaukee, their mission, Milwaukee also has a research mission. Both of those campuses have a mission of access, which means that they are expected to accept students who are less prepared. So they're not going to have the same success with graduation and retention and all of these other measures that UW-Madison would, which would mean that they would come out in much worse shape with this method of funding.
Talking to Karen Herzog from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at a proposal in the governor's budget, a budget still in the early stages, that would have some funding based on performance measures divvied up between UW system campuses. Looking at some recent analysis of this, this sounds a little like the education argument over competence versus improvement we heard of in some Senate confirmation hearings. Another way that some people suggested to reward performance is to look at, okay, let's look at campus A along these measures and reward improvement over time on those measures. Is that right?
That's exactly right, and it's how other states do it. If you're looking at an institution, you're saying, show us some improvement. That's something that an incentive is built in for that campus because it's only competing against itself. And so it makes sense to consider doing it that way, especially when you have all these campuses in Wisconsin with different missions and widely different student populations.
So in the case of a UW-Milwaukee, the competitive system might be an incentive for them to move away from that mission of inclusiveness, accepting more students, being an opportunity for kids to go to college, and toward being more selective along the lines of UW-Madison.
Exactly. You look at the National College Scorecard, and that's one of the things that people worry about a little bit, is that if you really focus on this competitive thing and rates, when you're looking at rates of improvement, that you have campuses that say, hey, well, you know, we're gonna try to attract more applicants, but we're gonna accept fewer so that they can appear to be more selective. In the same sense, you could have a campus that is really intended to be an access university. UW-Milwaukee, for example, has a lot of students from Milwaukee public schools. You wouldn't want to necessarily encourage them to accept fewer of them if access is their mission.
Let's put this number in context, $42.5 million. How does that stack up compared to general state aid to the UW system?
Well, that would be about 4% over the 2 years of the biennium, 4% of $2 billion for the 2 years. And, you know, one could argue, well, that's just kind of dipping a toe into the water, and it is to some degree, but $42.5 million still is a lot of money for the UW system considering all the cuts that it has sustained in recent years.
Yeah, so it's not huge, but it's not nothing. So has there been a sign of, this is an opening idea from the governor, or does it seem like this is pretty locked in? And what have we heard from legislators in response, too?
Well, it's still really early in the legislative process. The budget is out there now, but really in any serious discussions about, you know, how lawmakers would want to change perhaps some of the performance measures. I mean, there are 18 performance measures in there under like 5 different categories or 6 different categories. A lot can change between now and the time the budget is actually adopted in late June, perhaps, or early July. But I think there's a pretty good chance that we will see performance-based funding to some degree because it is something that a lot of states are looking at. And the idea is holding campuses accountable. It's holding them accountable for affordability, for access, and for success so that parents, when they send their kids to school, will know that their kids have a really good chance of getting a degree that will allow them to get a job after graduation.
As we wrap up, Karen, do you think this performance-based funding part of the budget is going to be the main point of controversy in the higher education budget, or is it going to be the free tuition thing or the overall budget increase levels? Where do you see the main points of contention?
Well, I think that good point, and you mentioned tuition increase. I think that's going to be contentious. I don't think there's an appetite for that among Republican lawmakers because it's basically going to cost $35 million just to give that break to students, which doesn't add up to that much money. But it's a big hole that they would have to fill with taxpayer dollars. So I think both performance-based funding and the tuition increase will get a lot of attention.
We'll leave it there for now, Karen. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Karen Herzog, higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joined us to break down a new analysis of Governor Walker's proposal that would divvy up over $42 million in funding for UW system campuses and base it on a competitive performance.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, executive orders are a way for presidents to bypass Congress to make policy. We'll find out how they work and the pros and cons of using them.
First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Increase Lapham came to Wisconsin to build a canal, but became the state's first scientist. Lapham's curiosity led him to investigate everything from trees to Indian mounds to the weather. Biographers Paul Hayes and Martha Berglund tell us about the life of this Wisconsin legend.
Increase Allen Lapham was 25 when he got to Milwaukee, and within days, he was walking the woods and walking the beach, taking measurements, taking temperature of the river, doing everything that his curiosity led him into.
He had been doing these same observations, gathering the same data since he was a young teenager. His first article about his observations was written when he was 16. The editor wasn't aware at the time that he was publishing a 16-year-old boy. He had almost no formal education, and that was a great sorrow of his. But as soon as he was able to work, he had to work because the family was a large one and they needed money, and he was able to earn money young as 13 on the Erie Canal.
It was canal work that brought him here, and for the first time in his life, he had arrived at the actual frontier of settlement. He's a curious man who's interested in every aspect of nature, and Wisconsin is an unexplored, undescribed blank tablet. And if anybody in the East, any botanist, any geologist, wants to know about the plants and the rocks here, they have to write to Lapham. And he develops a wide-ranging correspondence with the then greatest scientists in the country, not only in the United States, but also in Europe.
So he knew he was their eyes and ears on the frontier, and they were very excited that they were going to have this good observer. And he was very generous with his time and energy and sent many specimens, many letters, many descriptions to the East, to the South. He was sort of the point man for science in Wisconsin territory.
So the question comes up, why was he forgotten? He left behind so much material that it's hard to get your hands around it. The science he was working in at the time was cutting-edge science, brand new ideas that he was bringing to the frontier. He would do lectures that were just astonishingly modern for the time. But since then, in the century and a half since he died, the science he worked in has become settled science. It's the science you learn when you're in the primary grades.
So the star scientists became more and more the specialists. And Increase was a generalist on the frontier, and his kind of science was being replaced. One of the main reasons to me that Lapham is important is that he was, in some ways, a model citizen. He was honest, he was amazingly thorough in whatever he set out to do, and he said that in order to build a good society, we had to build it on a knowledge of where we had come from.
Martha Berglund and Paul Hayes are the authors of Studying Wisconsin, The Life of Increase Lapham. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook.
Increase Lapham also had a role in the founding of the Wisconsin State Herbarium, and to the surprise of staff at the herbarium, it turns out that the collection includes a century-old and long-forgotten fungal specimens that were collected by the famous scientist and educator George Washington Carver.
Ken Cameron joined us to talk about the discovery. He's a professor of botany at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the director of the Wisconsin State Herbarium. Ken, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, what can you tell us about this historic discovery?
Yeah, it was really a surprise to us. We have a very large collection of fungi, approximately 120,000 specimens. And when most people think of fungi, they're thinking of mushrooms. But these are not mushrooms. They're microfungi, or we sometimes call them parasitic fungi. They are the rusts and smuts and other nasty things like mildews that affect crop plants in particular. So we were funded by the National Science Foundation to digitize, in other words, to database our entire collection of these very important fungi. And we had no idea that George Washington Carver was even interested in them. Most people think of George Washington Carver and his famous work with peanuts. Mm-hmm. But in the process of databasing our collection, we came upon 25 specimens that were collected by the man himself.
And these, just to stick with the microfungi a bit, these are a big deal in agriculture. You mentioned something it was something like this that caused the great potato famine in Ireland, right? That was in this category?
Yes, exactly. And so many other crop plants. I mean, any of the farmers who are listening or people who have a home vegetable garden will recognize things like powdery mildew and blights. In the old days, white pine blister rust was a very important, devastating disease of the white pine timber industry. So these are potentially catastrophic fungi that cause diseases. Not all of them. Some of them are you know, benign. But in the early days of the university's founding, with our agricultural history, documenting these pathogenic or disease-causing fungi was very important to the early scientists.
And how did these specimens end up in Wisconsin?
So, to my understanding, I'm not a scholar of George Washington Carver, but I can tell you that he was the first African-American student at what became Iowa State University, and his mentor studied fungi, and these microfungi in particular. So he obviously received his training. He was then recruited to the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, where he continued his scientific study and collecting of these fungi in young North America. Many of the species were new to science. And as he collected these, he distributed them to different major universities around the country. And the University of Wisconsin in Madison was a young, growing powerhouse of research in the Midwest at the turn of the early 20th century. And so undoubtedly they came here in that way.
When I think of an archive of text material, I think, oh, there's books and maybe diaries and documents and things like that. What does a microfungus archive look like? What form
does
it take?
Well, it's certainly not very glamorous. if I were to show you these specimens, you'd probably give me a strange look. People who collect them are actually collecting little black spots or white powdery residues on the surfaces of plant leaves. So remember that these are the diseases of the plant. So we, in the specimen, not only get the fungus, but we get the host plant. And these are dried and they're packaged in envelopes with a label on the outside. So the specimen itself may not look all that attractive, but the history that is held within these is truly phenomenal.
Yeah, what stood out to you as you took a gander at the collection?
Well, so again, just the first thing was that we didn't even know that we had them. We're not the only museum that has these specimens. They're found around the country. But as we dug further, we came to see that it tells us a little bit about our history and our origin, that a prominent collector down in Alabama thought to send specimens here in the early days of our founding. And we were at one time a major research center in microfungi. I'm in the botany department, which is in the College of Letters and Science. One of our sister departments in the College of Agriculture is plant pathology, and they have kept this tradition alive of studying these parasitic fungi, even though we in the herbarium may not do that any longer.
Talking to Ken Cameron with the Wisconsin State Herbarium, talking about fungus samples collected by George Washington Carver. So you're digitizing this collection, a lot of stuff there. Are you expecting to find more surprises of one sort or another?
Yeah, I'm actually a little embarrassed to tell you how we found these specimens in the first place.
Oh, do tell us that.
Well, your listeners will find this amusing. We rely on a very large team of volunteers and students to help us manually database these records. And one of them had entered the word Alaska rather than Alabama for what was abbreviated ALA. And it was actually one of my colleagues in North Carolina who was combing the database online and said, hey, I think you've got something wrong in there. These Tuskegee is in Alabama, not in Alaska. And so I said, oh, thanks for letting me know. And she said, by the way, that's a specimen collected by George Washington Carver. And I said, wait a minute, you mean the African-American scientist? And so it all went from there.
Wow, that must have been an exciting day.
Yeah, so then, of course, we dug into the database and realized I think at this point we've found 28 or 30 of them, and we're going in alphabetical order. We're only up to the H's, so we expect that we're going to find several more.
So any chance you could have other treasures in your collection that you don't know about, or is this just kind of the once-in-a-lifetime fluke?
We always find treasures. interviewed with you, I think, last year or 2 years ago, where we found a very special specimen that was collected on the battlefield mm-hmm. during the Civil War. You may remember that story. So every day is an adventure. Every day is a new discovery. And we are happy that we can bring history back to life through these specimens.
So Wisconsin's home to this huge archive and now a digitized archive. How does that help our understanding, our research of the plant and, in this case, fungal world?
That's a great question. And the best way to answer it is that people who are looking at disease causing organisms today, whether they be viruses like Zika or bacteria or fungi, are very interested in knowing the origin, the source, how the genetics of those pathogenic organisms have changed through time. And these fungi, even though they're over 100 years old, we can actually extract DNA from them and compare the genetics today to what existed in 1900 and see what changes have occurred in the genome. So we've already gotten calls from researchers across campus wanting access to these specimens.
So if I'm a researcher, I've discovered a new blight, and I want to say, where'd this come from? I can compare and contrast with what's on hand there, compare the DNA, see if there's an old strain, a new strain, that
exactly.
sort of thing.
Exactly. It's our closest thing to a time machine. We can't go back and actually collect these things living, but through the preserved form in the herbarium, we can offer up those research materials.
Is there a way for people to come visit? Is there anything for them to see if they do?
We are open to the public, but we're not a museum in the sense that we have exhibits for the public to see. But certainly anyone who would like to make an appointment, come in. I'd be happy to show them the specimens themselves.
Nice. Ken, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
Ken Cameron is a professor of botany at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and director of the Wisconsin State Herbarium.
Coming up, we learn how presidential executive orders work and whether President Trump is using them more or less than past presidents. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Storytelling with a Beat on Snap Judgment. Tonight's theme, notorious. More money, more problems, more stories than you know what to do with. That's coming up tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
Now, President Trump has issued 26 executive orders since his administration took over in late January. One of the first and most controversial was the initial travel ban that was issued just 1 week after he took office.
I'm establishing new vetting measures to keep radical Islamic terrorists out of the United States of America. We don't want them here. We want to ensure that we are not admitting into our country the very threats our soldiers are fighting overseas.
While that initial flurry of executive orders has gotten a lot of attention, many presidents have issued hundreds during their time in office.
Historically, this tool has been used by different U.S. presidents to varying degrees and to achieve different goals. Our next guest says we can understand executive orders in part by thinking of U.S. presidents as CEOs of enormous corporations.
Daniel Gitterman is the Thomas Willis Lambeth Distinguished Chair in Public Policy at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's the author of the book Calling the Shots, The President, Executive Orders, and Public Policy. Daniel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. As we say in Chapel Hill, Madison is the second best college town in America.
Well, okay. I won't argue that now because we've got executive orders to talk about. And let's talk about the phrase because we've seen executive orders, administrative actions, presidential memoranda. Do these kind of fall under the general label of executive orders or executive actions?
So the two most common ones we're seeing are executive orders, which have official designations in the Federal Register and are publicized, and presidential memorandum, which are directive to agency or secretaries to carry out some action the president wishes. And those two together are probably the most common type of executive action right now.
And have we seen the use of those increase over time?
The numbers actually suggest historically that they're not actually increasing. FDR issued a record number of executive orders. So what we did see during the Obama presidency was growing use of this other tool called presidential memorandum. He certainly used that more. What seemed a little bit less common was many of these executive orders were signed without the fanfare that Trump has merited, the calling in of the White House press corps to the Oval Office to watch him actually read and sign the executive order. So they've become much more planned media events than they had in the past.
Yeah, I looked at the numbers of executive orders signed by various presidents over the years, and it varies up and down. But I wonder, is it so much the numbers or is it the scope? Because I imagine some of these are pretty trivial, you know, zinc recognition day type things, and some of them are really important and sweeping.
Yeah, and you know what I tried to do in my book was to identify three particular which seemed to me dramatic in terms of the scope of power use, but the number is misleading. I think you really have to dig deep into each one to really understand its impact, and that's been true even for the ones that Trump have ordered. Some have been quite sweeping and others less so.
And where does the president get this power? Why does the president have these powers?
Under the Constitution, the president has executive power. It is either based in that Constitution that they act, or from authority that was delegated to them through a law from Congress. And so in every executive order, you will see the first sentence to read either under the U.S. Constitution or under a specific congressional statute that gives them that authority or power to act.
Talking to Daniel Gitterman, author of the new book, Calling the Shots. It looks at presidents and their executive orders. You say while these tools have been around for a long time, you write that the Obama administration can be seen as a coming out party for executive orders. Why is that?
It was executive orders, but also presidential memorandum. And, you know, I think both in 1994, when President Clinton lost control of Congress, there began to be a strategy that the only way he would have any policy accomplishments was to go it alone. John Podesta, who was his chief of staff, also became an Obama advisor, and it was very much of a continuation of a strategy put in place with Bill Clinton. It intensified, actually, when Republicans gained control of Congress in 2010. So in both presidencies, after the midterm election, their legislative agenda was largely stuck in Congress, and this became the strategy to achieve any type of policy goals.
And you write, and a lot of your book focuses on this, what gives these executive orders and memoranda such heft is that the federal bureaucracy that the president administers is big. So there's a lot of power of the purse, I guess, which is usually what I think of as Congress is having. But they can really do a lot as a big employer, as a big purchaser, and as a big payer for services.
Yeah, one of the things that struck me just looking at the numbers since the New Deal is the dramatic size of federal procurement, the dramatic size of the federal workforce, and then just how much we spend in the purchase of health care. The federal government is the largest purchaser of health care through Medicare and Medicaid. And as the bureaucracy that implements those types of actions, the president has used those powers more and more to exercise political influence. And we've also seen what we call a politicization, where the White House itself is more and more calling the shots of what the federal bureaucracy does. And those types of orders or directives to secretaries basically say, you know, this is what the president would like to happen.
And there's been pushback in the Obama administration. There was gridlock between a Democratic president after a while and a Republican Congress. After President Trump was sworn in, here's House Speaker Paul Ryan from Wisconsin talking about President Obama and executive orders.
President Obama used his pen and phone and executive orders to exceed his power in our perspective. Everything that President Obama did by executive order, this new president can undo. We would like to see these things undone, and we'd like to see power restored to the people in the states, not to the federal government. And that is what this new president is doing. He's restoring the proper balance, and in our opinion, he is undoing a lot of damage that was done by the last president who exceeded his power.
So can we say that President Obama, for example, exceeded his power in the use of executive orders?
There were very few actions that Obama took. It was largely the immigration one that ran into some trouble in the courts, but the overwhelmingly number the judiciary thought were within his power. This is the type of issue, depending on who's in the White House, colors how you think about it. Paul Ryan prefers Trump's preferences on a lot of these policies issues. Trump certainly has the power to rescind a number of Obama orders. But in terms of executive power, Trump is using it just in different ways than Obama.
We're talking with Daniel Gitterman about his new book published by the Brookings Institution Press. It is called Calling the Shots, The President, Executive Orders, and Public Policy.
And we'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think that executive orders are an important tool to bypass gridlock, or is it taking away the role of the legislative branch? Did you agree with the executive orders issued by President Obama? And what about those that have already come out of the Trump White House? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation about presidential executive orders, how they work, what they do, and when they go too far.
And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you think executive orders should be used sparingly, or are they a good solution for when the legislative branch is gridlocked and maybe not getting much done? Do you support how much President Trump has been using this tool so far? Would you rather see policies move through Congress instead? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Daniel Gitterman is with us. His new book is called Calling the Shots, The President, Executive Orders, and Public Policy. You write about the ongoing turf war, in a way, the balance of power between the executive branch, the presidency, the legislative branch, Congress, and then the judicial, all the courts. And these executive orders, obviously a tool in the president's kit. And for the president to do something, you write, one person needs to agree to do a thing. Congress, of course, we could see gridlock between parties. The courts can disagree among themselves. So does this tip the balance maybe too far in the president's favor?
Well, they certainly have a first mover advantage, and we should also acknowledge that sometimes after acting, Congress comes along and will approve it. Much of civil rights legislation, anti-discrimination legislation, started with the president and an order as the first mover, and Congress later came along. So, you have models where Congress will come along. Several folks criticized the book because I didn't have a conclusion per se whether this growing use of executive order is a bad thing or a good thing, and the legislative branch, Congress, should be the one that makes it. I have a slightly different view, is that presidents are elected officials too, and we get to vote for them, and we get to change direction if we don't like the direction they're going in. And I see executive orders as they were in the 2016 campaign and will likely be in the 2020 campaign, an issue for voters to decide about and whether those orders go in a direction that they support or not. And if not, it's time to vote in a new president.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Joyce is with us in Madison. Joyce, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Joyce?
I'm just calling about the executive order question. I feel that, if they can reverse, the next president can reverse the executive order, then, you know, you're just kind of going back and forth on this. You're playing a flip-flop game.
Joyce, thanks for the call. And that reminds me, Daniel, of the Mexico City rule, so-called, about whether recipients of U.S. foreign aid could talk about abortions. I mean, that's like a ritual now. Democrats take it out. Republicans put it back in.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few highly contested areas. One is the abortion issue. The other is labor and management, where presidents go back and forth. But there are others that very much survive the test of time. And one of the areas where Obama moved was to prohibit federal contractors and the federal government from discriminating based on gender identity or sexual orientation. And all the signals have been is that Trump is not going to undo that one. So there are areas that are, as your caller said, ping pong, highly politicized ones, but many of them don't get reversed.
Thanks a lot for that call, Joyce, at 800-642-1234. Let's talk about checks and balances. How often do either Congress or courts say, okay, President, you've gone too far with this executive order?
Congress rarely, because it would require far more than a majority. It would require a two-thirds majority, because if a majority decided to rescind an executive order, president would likely veto it, and it would require a two-thirds congressional override. So you rarely see that kind of majority in Congress that's willing to exert an override of a president's executive order. So Congress rarely steps in. They can also change a statute, but that's hard too. And you do see the courts placing some limits. I think you've seen in this administration that the courts are going to be called upon a lot. And one of the things that's different about this administration is these executive orders usually get vetted internally within the Justice Department, the Office of White House Counsel, before they're issued. This administration issued some of their most controversial orders very, very quickly without a lot of internal legal vetting, which has, I think, opened them up to even more significant court challenge.
And let's talk about the symbolism of these. You mentioned President Trump, more so than past presidents, has made these signing ceremonies a regular event, or he did early on anyway. How much of this is substantial for any president versus, hey, I'm showing my supporters that I'm doing something?
Well, clearly there's a political and a symbolic piece, and it wasn't by accident that Obama chose some of his campaign issues. I'm going to repeal Obamacare. I'm going to shut down immigration from these countries as early orders. So there is a piece which is symbolic and political. The other piece, which is for voters and constituents, is they watch the evening news or listen to their local radio station or open up their newspaper, and the headlines are Trump acts to do X, and they assume that it's done, it's over, and don't follow exactly what happens with the order after it's issued. But in terms of political impact for voters, it's huge.
Right, and let's wrap up on that point. How much actually happens from that order? How much of that is just setting a course that hopefully Congress will sign on to with the funding, say, that would be required to enact an order?
You know, I think it's a little of both. I think, for example, a very initial order that suggested not enforcing mandates in the Affordable Care Act, that is going to require congressional action. And you see that shifting now to Congress about what to do with the Affordable Care Act. There are others, for example, a freeze on federal hiring. That happened immediately. The federal government is doing no more hiring at the moment. And some which have to go through the rulemaking process will take a little bit more time. And so people really have to pay attention to the substance and scope of each order as they come.
Daniel, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've been talking to Daniel Gitterman. He's the Thomas Willis Lambeth Distinguished Chair in Public Policy at UNC Chapel Hill. He's the author of a new book titled Calling the Shots, The President, Executive Orders, and Public Policy. Still time for you to share your thoughts on executive orders, say of past presidents, President Obama, or the current administration and President Trump. Share those over on the Central Time Facebook page.
More police officers may be turning in their badges as an increasing number of public safety workers are reaching retirement age in Wisconsin. One northern Wisconsin police department is set to see a third of its officers become eligible for retirement over the next 3 years. Danielle Kading rode along with one cop in Superior who's hanging it up after 26 years.
My brother George, he looks like he's ready to retire, but he's not.
That's Superior Police Officer Gary Gothner. At 55, he's the oldest cop patrolling the city streets. He's getting ready to head out for his third 12-hour shift on days. But Officer Gothner won't be driving a squad for much longer because he's retiring in April. He says it's no fun chasing down younger criminals as a 55-year-old man.
I don't want to be the guy that dies on this job. This job has been wonderful to me. Absolutely great. I love it. I can't imagine doing anything else. But, you know, sometimes you got to know when to go. Life is short.
He says a lot has changed since he first became a cop. Gothner remembers dealing with more alcohol-related crimes from Superior's bar crowd. Now he says they respond to more calls for service and issues stemming from drug abuse.
You'd be surprised at how much drugs are out there. The drugs is just crazy what's out there.
Gothner says they also didn't have body cameras, tasers, and computers in the squad cars. He says the technology they use is both a blessing and a curse.
Nowadays, with these ambushes and people not liking the police, you don't like to get distracted. You know, you can get so focused on doing something here, you don't know what's going on around you.
He feels people are putting law enforcement under the microscope more than ever since the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri.
They all pull out their phones and everybody's recording and everyone's waiting for the cop to screw up. That's the biggest difference I've found in 25 years.
Officer Gothner is among 236 public safety workers in the state who are eligible to retire this year. State figures show the number of those professionals eligible for retirement is increasing by about one-third over the next 5 years. Bob Rosch is one of them. He recently stepped down as president of the Wisconsin Chiefs of Police Association. He's retiring this month. Rosch says one reason numbers may be increasing is that public safety workers can retire earlier.
You know, anywhere from basically 50 on up, you can retire at any point in time.
But Rosch says whether those who are eligible will actually retire is anyone's guess.
It's nice to be able to say you can retire that early, but it's not reality for a lot of people because, you know, health insurance is probably the biggest factor there that prevents them from retiring that early.
Officer Gothner agrees that is the sole reason a lot of cops are hanging in there.
You got these family members. A family health care plan, if they were to retire, their health care would cost over $2,000 a month.
Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander says they can't afford to wait and see with about one-third of his officers up for retirement over the next 3 years. He says they're hiring more recruits now to cut back on overtime for officers and meet public safety needs.
I certainly could see that the added stress of policing today might make it easier for somebody once they reach eligibility to say, hey, it's, you know, I've put in my time and I'm going to retire versus, you know, maybe I'll stick around for a couple more years.
Alexander says the Superior City Council approved using around $100,000 typically reserved for other purposes to pay for hiring more officers this year and next. As for Gothner, he doesn't know what he'll do when he puts away the uniform, but he says he wants to go out now while he still has a decent reputation. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.